Still, of course, the author of the piece. This is Bina Kaskidia for Monday, December 9th, 2013. Thanks so much, Sam Parrish, engineer of the show today. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin and Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin and Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we start, I just wanted to spend just a moment thinking about Nelson Mandela and just marveling at how amazing it's been to spend at least my last 64 years on the planet with him, and to know that I have experienced in my lifetime watching a man of that amount of greatness. And it's really amazing to see in his death how many people he's brought together, ranging from Barack Obama, which is not surprising, to John Boehner, to I noticed last night when I went on the Apple.com website that there was a big picture of Nelson Mandela there. So I'm glad to know that maybe that memory of Nelson Mandela may help Apple to change some of their work practices in China. So hopefully the spirit will spread. So this morning we're going to be talking about nature murals. And Portland is noted for its abundant urban natural areas and the wildlife that abounds in many spots not far from Portland. But the city is also becoming a center for nature murals that help residents become more aware of the wealth of nature areas around them. This morning we'll take a look at a couple major art projects in recent years that highlight two of Portland's emerging nature parks, Oaks Bottom and Selwood, and the Markham Trail that winds through the Tualatin Mountains in southwest Portland. My guests are Leslie Paul Caspar, who was involved with Lynn Takata's public mosaic for the Markham Trail near Dunaway Park, and Mike Haug, who was the inspiration for Art FX Murals Mega Mural overlooking the Bluff Trail through Oaks Bottom. Leslie and Mike, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And now you have headphones.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Leslie, this was your idea. So I wanted to start by asking you, why do you think we should be having a show about nature murals? Why are they so important?
Well, I've admired some of the murals for years, and also I have kind of a personal connection with a couple of them, like Mike does. And working with Lynn Takata, I was one of hundreds of volunteers, not a special volunteer, but one of hundreds that worked on the mosaic that she did for the Markham Trailhead that I would encourage people to go visit. It really is inspiring. I mean, some of this work can really inspire a person, and if you haven't already experienced nature in Portland, but also it confirms and supports that kind of experience. So I think it's really important.
Well, actually, these two murals that we're focusing today, I take a personal interest because I used to hike a lot on the Markham Trail when I lived in southwest Portland, long before the mural, long before the nature shelter. There's still houses on that little road. And I was up there just a few weeks ago showing the trail to a friend, and I saw the mural for the first time, and it was quite beautiful. beautiful. And of course, the mural that Mike helped inspire on, along the Oaks Bottom Trail is a highlight of the neighborhood that I live in now and has really transformed what was one of the ugliest walls in Portland. So I want to sort of start by talking about why... Well, one of the limitations about nature in the city is that you can have a beautiful spot like Oaks Bottom bordered by prison walls, so it seems, which is what the Portland Memorial Wall seemed to be like. So how do murals like the Oaks Bottom mural help to enhance nature areas and maybe help to bring more attention to the fact that they even exist?
Well, I'll speak to the Oaks Bottom, the Portland Memorial Mausoleum. That actually started out... very serendipitously. I just happened to be walking on West Burnside and saw a beautiful mural of a Blitz Weinhard beer bottle. And I asked who was doing it and was directed around the corner. The fellow wasn't there. Mark Bennett was not in his office. And I just left him a note and said, I want to put a heron on a building. Would you be willing to volunteer to do it? And he actually called me a couple days later and said he lived across the river and hated that building because it was so butt ugly. And so that's that. We started with one 50 foot tall by, I don't know, 80 foot wide great blue heron back in 1991. And the mausoleum was kind enough to let us use their structure. And then, I don't know, 4 years ago, Mark called me up and said, when are we going to finish that building? And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, I've been waiting for how many, 91 to 4 years ago, quite a while. And I said, well, let's talk about it. Went over and kicked the dirt a bit. And I said, how much is it going to cost? And he said, $30,000. So that started the fundraising effort. And the mausoleum had actually just changed hands. So I had to go back to the new owners, Michael Ash and his partner, to get permission to do the entire building. And we can talk more about some of the details. But it's the largest hand-painted mural in North America. Nobody has contradicted me on that anyway. Yeah. Hand painted mural on a building.
I find it interesting that the inspiration for that mural started with a beer bottle, which sounds really Portland and maybe really Mike Houck. But it also, there have been lots of bottles of things painted on the sides of walls in Portland for a couple decades now. Would you say that before you had the inspiration from the beer bottle to have a heron on the wall by Oaks Bottom, that there were any other nature murals anywhere in Portland?
Well, you know, I wasn't actually, I think the one that I'm most familiar with is I live in Northwest Portland. There was a really beautiful one on Food Front. That's kind of a combination of a mosaic and a mural. So I had seen, you know, a couple around and in my travels around the, you know, internationally and nationally, I'd been to cities where their murals were really commonplace. But I hadn't thought that much about it until that day, and I just, you know, saw this beautiful representation and a hand-painted representation. I thought, and actually the way it started was I talked to Bud Clark, and he agreed to declare the Great Blue Heron as Portland City Bird. So then it seemed totally logical with this huge canvas overlooking Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge to get a heron on it.
Well, I'm thinking it's kind of interesting that mural on Food Front, which I've long admired, actually replaced a natural area because there used to be a beautiful herb garden there. So that's another thing. how have we gone? And I'll throw this out to Leslie. How have we moved from replacing nature with nature murals to maybe enhancing nature with nature murals?
I wanted to also mention that when I was in, this kind of goes off back to what Mike was saying, other cities, when I was in Philadelphia in 1999, you know, the devastation in that city was just pretty bad. And I was just taken by the wonderful murals, the spirit of the murals in that city. They were very proud of their murals, and they published a book, the Parks Bureau there published a booklet on their murals. And that seemed to heighten the beauty and the good feeling that people had in their neighborhoods when the rest of the neighborhood looked so bad. So I think that that's one thing that can happen with it. But yeah, what happens when nature is replaced by buildings? It's that whole thing about, oh, there's this wall now. What do we do with it? And I remember on Division that they painted a bunch of sunflowers on, I don't know if you remember that, on the wall there. It made it a little bit nicer before it got gentrified.
Actually, wasn't those sunflowers that they were declared illegal, and that's what was the motivation for having like a whole mural act passed?
That and the mural on Mirador, which is a wonderful store on Division also. And so there was controversy, and for a long time, no murals could be painted. They had to be a very small size. And now that's been changed. And so Title IV of the Bureau of Development Services says the mural is a hand-produced work of visual art that is tiled or painted by hand directly upon or affixed directly to an exterior wall of a building. No computer-generated prints or images, which is kind of interesting because other cities will allow that. But this is what Portland says. So things have to be hand-done, hand-painted.
So Portland.
Yes, it is. And another connection I have to the Oaks Bottom or the mausoleum painting is that Shane Bennett was a good friend of my son's, and actually Mark and Shane and Cheryl lived down the street from us, and he looked at that building, and we looked at that building, and I'm so glad that we have this remembrance of Shane on that building that I can look at and enjoy.
Yes, well, for the listeners, by the way, Mark Shane's father did the original Great Blue Heron, and there's a whole story behind that. We could take the whole hour just talking about that process. But his son, Shane, is the one who did 99%, along with Dan Cohen, a local artist, the mausoleum mural at Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge. And he tragically died just 3 months after we dedicated it in a snowmobile accident in Colorado. So I'm glad that Leslie brought Shane up, because he really is the one most responsible for that mural.
I also, this is another sad thing that I think it was about last year or a year and a half ago, there's some graffiti's actually hit that mural now. Mm. Most of the graffiti was on the green wall below the mural, but last year somebody graffitied over the signatures.
Oh,
I don't
yeah.
know if there's any way to reproduce that, because that really broke my heart when I saw
it. I just noticed that the other day. That is my understanding is that taggers, you know, respect that kind of work. I was kind of blown away when I saw that they tagged over their names.
Well, just another aside, another place that murals play a really important role is in Richmond, California, which is a city that suffers some maybe even more intense issues than Philadelphia mm-hmm. does. And there's been an incredible program going on for the last, I don't know, 8-10 years, simultaneously growing gardens all over Richmond, which have been traditional part of Richmond, but now they're a little bit more institutionalized. And one of the places where there's big community gardens is through the Richmond Greenway, which is a Rails to Trails project. It used to just be a brown way, a little yeah. kind of dirt path along the railroad tracks where they used to be. And now there's incredible gardens that are being planted by a group called Urban Tilth. And there's murals lining the greenway, and there's mosaics, garbage can covers, and some mosaic seats, and it's a very beautiful area. And we were doing an interview a couple of years ago with Doria Robinson, who's the director of Urban Tilth, sitting right in front of this mural, and she's talking about how nobody's tagging the murals and how amazing it is. And she looks over and she goes, "It's still true." Well, the next year we did another interview with her, and as we were looking at it, maybe a month later, we saw that there were some tags mm-hmm. behind her, and it hasn't gotten too much worse, and because we were just down there a few weeks ago. But it seems that as much as we like to believe that taggers aren't going to attack murals, it seems that there isn't enough education yet, because they are attacking them in several places, and seeing that in Oaks Bottom was really kind of heartbreaking.
I think it's really important that the community be involved, and not only from the get-go of the design, but also the maintenance of these murals, because they are something that does age in place and needs to be renewed. I'm actually involved in a project. We're trying to get a mural that I worked on, a mosaic that I worked on as a child in my church congregation, renewed and moved, actually. So we're really, it's going to be a big project, but those things are important to people. They come back and they say, well, where's the mural? I remember that. I loved it. And it's something that can go on, as we know, in ancient cities and depicted in Pompeii and so forth, that show the beauty and the grace of, especially of the outdoors and of natural life. So that's important. And I want to say, too, that I wasn't involved directly in this, but I've enjoyed it on my walks on Terwilliger. Our Hillsdale neighborhood got together and got a mural painted about the history of land use in Hillsdale. And Angelina Marino and Joel Heidel did this 932-square-foot bright mural in 2011, and it's on Capitol and Terwilliger, and you might want to go by and look at that. It shows the cows that used to be in the Raz Dairy, and it shows trilliums and all kinds of things that you find along Terwilliger, as well as at Markham also shows all the kinds of plants that you would find in the park. And if you want to go and see more about the mosaic that Lynn Takata worked with a huge community of people and kids from Shriners and all kinds of folks, there's a nice short video on OPB right now that you can look at on their website.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about nature murals in Portland and maybe around the rest of the world as well a little bit. And my guests are Leslie Paul Caspar, who was the original director of Portland's Community Gardens, and she's still a community activist on too many boards to mention without running out of time today. And Mike Houck, who's the director of Urban Green Spaces and the author of a couple versions of Wild in the City. And we're talking in particular about two murals that they're both involved in, the amazing mega mural above Oak's Bottom along the walls of the Portland Memorial, and a mosaic at the trailhead of Markham Trail. I want to talk, I think people may be a little bit more familiar with the Oak's Bottom mural since it's been around, for 5, 6 years?
I've lost track, yeah, four or five
years. It's actually starting to fade a little bit, that's how old it is, but it's just become a landmark. It's just like a place where people use it as a reference point in the same way that they probably use the coin tower. And it's so much nicer.
Thank you.
Yes.
The other mural, which I wanted to focus on for a moment more, is this mural at the trailhead of Markham Trail, because I want to tie that in with kind of the whole renaissance of the Markham Trail, which, when I discovered it back in the 80s, I mean, it was this amazing discovery that there was this trail. I was living in Lair Hill, and it's a pretty urban neighborhood, and I was missing the days when I lived near Mount Hood. And one day I was walking along Dunaway Park and found this little trail up to Terwilliger Boulevard. That was my great discovery. Yeah. And then I started walking along Terwilliger and came across it wasn't even marked. I mean, it was just this trail that went up and it went all the way to Council Crest. And it was one of these things when you're living really close in the inner city and you yearn for some nature, and there was this nature. Now, 35 years later, there's not just a very well-defined set of trails, but there's this incredible shelter. It looks like a little, there's a little like amphitheater kind of, mm-hmm. I guess, for mm-hmm. the Rangers talks.
Yes.
And it's a little miniature national park in there. So I want to talk about why the genesis for the mosaic and what role that you see that the mosaic plays in helping people to appreciate what they will discover if they start going up on those trails.
Well, it's my understanding that the Friends of Markham Trail, Markham Park, were really instrumental in this, and I do believe there was a RAC grant, Regional Arts and Culture Council grant, for this, as are involved in a lot of other murals and mosaics around Portland. And the genesis of that, I'm not quite sure who started that idea. We need to give them credit.
Actually, Mike, do you know a little bit about that, about the genesis? I'm just thinking ahead of my next question for you guys.
Oh, on Markham.
On Markham, but on just the murals in general, what got RAC to start funding murals as opposed to the city denying them?
Well, there's a very active mural community in Portland. Yeah. So they working with Peggy Kendellon is the staffer at RAC, who's responsible for that program.
Yeah.
Okay. But back to Markham now, the genesis of Markham mural.
And so actually, the Friends of Markham were involved in the planning and the construction, and I know Parks and Recreation was very involved as well. And there are work parties up there all the time. And one time I was working with this friend of mine, Judy, on the mural, and the work party chair, leader came down the hill and checked in with us. And people coming off the trail would come and look at it. And it will be a nice place to do environmental education with children as well as with adults. It's a starting point and an ending point, and it just solidifies that whole experience.
So you get to look at the mural before you start up on the trail. You mm-hmm. see what you're going to see, and then you come back from your hike and you check out to see if that's what you saw. And
yeah.
is there also information about what those plants and animals might be?
Or? There is, and there's also information about the history of the area on the poles under the shelter too, which is really interesting. I'd never really looked at them, so it gives you time for pause to think about the fact that this just didn't magically happen. This area has been revered, and there's a long history about Dunaway Park and the Terwilliger Parkway, and Terwilliger just celebrated its 100th year last year, so there's lots more to do.
And it's probably worth pointing out, anybody who's seen the mural at Oak's Bottom would intuit this, but it's at the other, that mural's at the other end of the spectrum with regard to community involvement. I mean, I obviously checked in with Portland Parks and Recreation and Friends of Oak's Bottom Wildlife Refuge and so forth. But that is a 55,000 square foot mural painted on a building that you had to have scaffolding to get to. So obviously that was a group of professionals, Mark Bennett, Shane Bennett, and Dan Cohen, who did that work. And especially if you stand on the roof and kind of look out over Oak's Bottom, you can appreciate how, number one, I'm hopeful that we won't have a huge problem over time with maintenance, because nobody can actually get to it other than that lower section that you referenced earlier. They're very, very different scales and very different approaches to how they were created.
And I think it's really important to choose an appropriate site. I don't know a lot of the history about the murals at Wilshire Park. Peggy Glasscock, who's my colleague, also retired, knows more than I do about them. But Anna Garibay painted those in 2008, and they have received a lot of tagging. They're in a structure inside, and so someone can hide in there and deface them. So it's really important, I think, to look at where these paintings or mosaics will be, that the public can see them, that they can be protected.
Well, it's a funny thing. I don't know if I can exactly get into the mindset of a graffiti artist or people who perceive themselves to be graffiti artists, but there seems to be some attitude when somebody does this really beautiful public art and is a very skilled artist, or if it's a collective action of the community, like the Markham mm-hmm. mural, that perhaps it triggers either the creative impulses mm-hmm. of the graffiti artist or some kind of competition or some kind of ego issue, that they have to put themselves there. And I just wonder if there was a way to incorporate them in the process of making the public art so that they don't feel like they have to come out and basically deface it once it's done.
Well, and I was in Buenos Aires a year and a half, 2 years ago, and they have an incredible mural program there. And it did start as a basically the catalyst, where there were taggers all over the city, and they actually worked with those
mm-hmm. That's good.
Those taggers who basically evolved their art into this incredibly a diverse mural painting society in Buenos Aires.
I want to tag onto that too, so to speak. I was in New York visiting my son in October, and Banksy is all the rage. And so we were out looking for Banksy things, and I was on the High Line looking at some of the
tagging. Just explain who Banksy is for those people who aren't as hip.
Yeah.
Who is Banksy?
Banksy is a very prominent mural graffiti artist who clandestinely puts his artwork up, and then people discover it. He also did a moving truck with to try to show animals being hauled to slaughter. And that was kind of a statement, political statement, too. And it was driving around Brooklyn and driving around Manhattan.
But the difference between Banksy and the people who made it defacing the murals that we're talking about is that he is an artist.
Yes, he is.
And this shows a great deal of craft. Also, doesn't he get a lot of money for some of his stuff?
I know, it's amazing.
He's the most highly paid graffiti artist, I think.
But also, only 3 weeks old when I was back there were these wonderful murals under the Brooklyn Bridge on the Brooklyn side. And those were just fantastic. They had a competition for those. So some of this engenders more excitement about beautifying some areas that are typically not too wonderful. And so when you go under those overpasses or whatever, you're just kind of excited by seeing these beautiful murals. So it can really help the whole feeling of the city.
And speaking of making something more beautiful, I really do think I need to give a shout out to Dave Schroeder and Michael Ash, who are co-owners of the Portland Memorial Mausoleum, because that building was pretty ugly. It took a huge amount of work on the part of Shane and Dan and the rest of their crew to prepare that 55,000 square foot area. They had to go in and grind thousands of rebar chunks that were
sticking out of the
wall, and power wash the entire wall. So obviously Portland Memorial Mausoleum benefited tremendously, but the neighborhood did as well, because that building was not very attractive prior to the mural being applied.
It also shows how a business can be communicative with the community, or be helping the community, because right across the street in their parking lot every Wednesday during the summer is the farmers market. And it just shows the a real good feeling about them being there. And I think people feel better about them.
Just a little bit of comment about that in between when it was the original Portland Memorial owners, and now it's actually Wilhelm, who used to be down the street in a place that's now an excellent restaurant called Relish, I think. And before that, it was The Woods, which was a wonderful night spot. But in between that, the building, the whole business was actually owned by Californians. So it was like kind of an absentee ownership. And I don't think there was much community involvement while Portland Memorial was owned elsewhere. But having local ownership, and that was one of the things that Wilhelm kind of promoted when they took over Portland Memorial, was that we're local, we're part of the neighborhood. And I think that they really are a part of the neighborhood. And when the farmers market moved over to their parking lot several years ago, to me it was it was another neighborhood transformation. So you have on one side of Portland Memorial the farmers market every Wednesday in the spring and summer and fall, and then on the other side this beautiful mural, and then Oaks Bottom, and it all kind of ties in the best, I think, of that neighborhood. So Mike, I'm curious about, you talk about how ugly that wall was, which I think a lot of people who used to walk in Oaks Bottom would share that feeling. What is the difference between walking in a nature area where you have this kind of barrier, that's this industrialized barrier that is like the antithesis of nature, and having that be your border, and having there be a mural that is a reflection of what's in the natural area that you're in?
Well, one of my main motivations for working with Mark and Shane to do the whole building was I just noticed people running, cycling, whatever, on the Springwater and the Willamette Trail. And I was just curious. I wondered how aware they were of what they were passing by, this incredible 160-acre wetland, which is, you know, Portland's first official urban wildlife refuge, and whether they were really giving a lot of thought to what was there. So the purpose for the murals, from my perspective at any rate, in addition to beautifying that building, was hoping that people would just, you know, maybe glance over. And I've seen this happen, actually. People on their bike, they look over and go, whoa, they stop, and they look out, and then they start seeing herons and waterfowl and so forth. So that was the main motivation for doing it, above and beyond the beautification effort. And I think, you know, I think people do have a different attitude toward Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge by virtue of having that reflection, as you put it, almost literally reflection off of the water. You can see, you know, you're standing there looking at a great blue heron, and there's the heron on the mural, and they're both reflected in that pond. I don't know, it's a powerful force for, you know, a better attitude, I think, about Oaks Bottom.
There is one funny little detail in that mural. Not such a detail, actually. It's rather large. There's Mount Hood, which is kind of a fanciful portrayal of Mount Hood.
Yep. Well, there was a fair amount of artistic license. For example, Dan Cohen, I asked them to do two cottonwood trees on the north toward the north, which stand behind two real cottonwood trees. So this time of year when there are no leaves on it, it looks like there are two trees there. If you look, when you walk along the Oaks Bottom Trail and you're right below the mural, if you look up at the tree on the left, there's a knothole, which is an eye. So they did some really kind of cool little artistic flourishes, I guess. Dan Cohen was responsible for that one. That people
no gargoyles or anything like
no gargoyles.
Actually, I was debating which photograph I have of the mural to put on. I was thinking about I have some photographs of those trees, but I thought that won't be as representative to people. But maybe when I get back, I'll throw that one up on the website too, because those trees are so cool. And to me, in a way, they're the most exciting part of that mural, because they really bring you into like a deep woods feeling, and they work so beautifully with the real trees. So whose idea was that to do the trees? That was your idea?
Because there were two trees there, and there were all kinds of cool little side stories about this mural. One of which was I was photographing Shane Bennett one day, working diligently on a kingfisher, and as he was painting, and I was taking photos of a female Anna's hummingbird was buzzing him, three or four inches from his face, and he said, "What is that?" I said, "Oh, that's an Anna's hummingbird." He said, "Send me a picture." So that night, I emailed him a male Anna's hummingbird, and the next day, there's this giant male Anna's hummingbird on the mural that he just decided to throw in.
That was very prescient of him, because now there's like a major breeding colony of Anna's hummingbirds down there. So
there are a lot of them.
Just one thought. I use that mural a lot as a reference to identify birds that are in the bottoms, and I'm wondering if it'd be possible to put one of those little replications of the mural on this boardwalk that's right underneath the mural, and then you can have like a numbered, each bird is numbered, and then have what they are, because it would be helpful to me. I mean, I've sort of, what I do is that, actually I find that the pictures on the mural help me to kind of get a better mental image of what I've just seen down in the pond, and it also helps when the light is kind of obscuring the plumage of the birds, and then I go home and I look them up. But it'd be great to have it right there,
or maybe up on Selwood Boulevard.
Both places.
You can see all eight walls from Selwood Boulevard. If you're on the trail, you only see six of the walls. I hadn't thought about that. Well, Another little project to take on.
Right now, I was actually thinking about the last couple of days, because there are so many different ducks down there now, and they're all freezing. In fact, the other day they were doing an emperor penguin huddle in the water. But I was looking at them and thinking, well, I can identify a bunch of these now, but there's some I really don't know what they are, and I would just love to be able to look and see right now what they are. And maybe might be nice beyond just doing an identification of what's on the mural. Then the other one could be just birds you're seeing different times a year.
The other thing I'd like to see are some structures that reflect nature a little more in our environment in the city. And Mike, I have to thank you for starting the Blue Heron Week and for highlighting the heron. And I actually put in my vote for the new bridge to be called the Blue Heron Bridge. I don't know if it will be, but it looks to me like a heron with its wings stretched out. And we also have the osprey and just all the different kinds of wildlife that you've brought attention to for Portlanders. I really thank you for that.
Good,
and the peregrine falcon, you and Bob Salinger, thank you for that. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibu Community Radio. My guests are Mike Houck and Leslie Paul Kaspar. We're talking about nature murals in Portland, which are starting to abound. Now, is this something, do you see that this is just like the beginning of a movement? Do you think there's going to be a lot more nature murals?
I think with this new law, it allows it. And so it has to be hand-produced, which is great, because that gets a lot of artists involved. There are a lot of murals indoors, because there's a wonderful one at Multnomah Art Center that everyone can see when they go in. There are private murals, but it's really wonderful to see more public murals. I mean, we harken back to those murals in the old St. John's post office that is now a private building. In the days of the work what was it called?
WPA.
WPA, thank
Works
you.
Project Administration.
Right. And there were lots of murals done. And, you know, I just am happy to see that Portland is allowing that to come back with this new Title IV. So there's a whole procedure I looked up online to see how you would start and apply for it. You have to get a permit but and meet with the neighborhood, which is really important because the view shed is really critical to all of us. It's like when someone puts something up that's objectionable, that's not beautiful, and of course that's in the eye of the beholder, then everyone has to see that. But if it's something that is gorgeous and people really love, then it's an addition. That's a kind of a fine line, you know. It's a tough one, but I guess that the Bureau of Development Services is going to help us with that. And the permit fee is only $50.
Well, actually, you talk about kind of beauty being in the eye of the beholder, and I'm thinking about the Portland City Repair, or City Repair Project.
Yeah.
And some of the they do murals on streets, which is another interesting thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure it's still there, but for a while on the corner, at the intersection of 34th and
Yamhill,
right? There's a big sunflower,
yeah,
which some people just love, and some people just hate it. And I don't know, I guess all the people who live around that corner, I'm assuming they all bought into it. At least the person who was responsible for it claimed that was true. But, and that was, in some ways, it's funny because it's on the street, so you don't have to look at it the same way you do when it's up on a wall. But in some ways, because it's on the street and you have to walk across it, and if somebody has a visceral reaction, you know, against walking on something, some kind of painted object. So I wonder how that can all be sort of synthesized so that people can come together in their disagreement, perhaps, about what their aesthetics are.
It must be good because I was walking through there on one of our Friday walks, and there was a person from out of town that was there taking a picture of it and enjoying it and looking at the poetry and the, I guess, the little book stands and so forth. So, you know, it's something that brings people together. I was just looking at some other artwork online that it's a concept of doing crosswalks differently, and they're bold designs with one that looks like a zipper and one that has hopscotch on it. And, you know, playful things are good for us. It doesn't always have to be the regulational-looking kind of crosswalk that we have.
Well, I like the notion of the ones I've encountered in North Portland and the one you're referring to in Southeast. I think they're good traffic calming devices as well. I think people tend to slow down whether they're on a bike or a pet or in a car, that it tends to create a little more serene environment in around that intersection.
And I think it depends. I mean, actually, I like the one at Sherritt Square in Sowood. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of a sweet little corner. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because it's very different from Yamhill and 34th. It's kind of tucked away. Who knows about this little intersection except the people in the neighborhood, right, as opposed to people who just wandered a block off of Belmont Street and find themselves in a giant sunflower.
Yeah.
So I think that there, I mean, I know that what City Repair is trying to do is to connect us to the urban environment more and to make it part of, instead of creating public conversations and creating a, basically, I guess, an Italian piazza feel, you know, in places. And I wonder how, besides just kind of having people feel like they can come together more comfortably in urban areas, how we bring nature into that more. Because my sense, like the Portland's living room, Pioneer Square, my biggest problem with it from the very beginning is it's so unnatural. It's so Italian, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like not a single living thing there. So how do we perhaps create gathering areas in the city that are both natural and beautiful and have artifacts? And maybe how do murals perhaps enhance that?
Yeah, or art in general. Actually, the weather machine that's no longer functioning but did for many years was being created by Dick and Nancy Ponzi and I think Ray Grimm and a couple other local folks. And I got wind that they were going to put a pelican in there, and I called them up and said, what the hell are you thinking? We have a city bird. It should be a great blue heron. And to their credit, they redesigned it and put a great blue heron in it. And that it's unfortunate that the thing doesn't function right now.
Because it was quite lovely.
For those of your listeners that did not experience it in the early days.
And where is this weather station?
It's right in Pioneer Square, and it's a column with a ball at the top. And at noon every day, a trumpet would go off, and mist would spray out. And then there were three icons. One was the sun, the other was a dragon. The sun was for fair weather, the dragon was for storm. And I don't know, the Great Blue Heron was probably for if it was going to be raining.
Yeah.
And each of them would come out, and then whatever the weather was going to be the next day, that icon would come up. Frequently the Great Blue Heron, of course. So there, you know, there was a case in point where, you know, Portland City Bird was in fact, you know, that icon was incorporated into the design. You know, it's interesting you mentioned the fact that it's based, you know, it's obviously, it is a piazza, it's all hardscape, but that's fine from my perspective, and it really is very Olmstedian, I think, in that, you know, John Charles Olmsted in 03 recommended Portland should have a comprehensive park system. And by that, he meant areas like Pioneer Square, but also like areas like Oaks Bottom and Forest Park. So we have a whole continuum of parks in the city of Portland, and now regionally, that, you know, meet your objective, I think.
Actually, what really meets my objective is I just last summer for the first time wandered around the North Pearl District and the series of parks there, starting with Jameson Park and moving on. And it just kind of goes into the river. And even though that's a really industrial port part of the river, you sort of transcend everything that's human made. So I was just thrilled to, just, again, one of my great discoveries in Portland is like discovering what has been redeveloped. And this is all new development. And yet it doesn't feel like the early Pearl development, which felt like just planted down the city. This feels really a lot more organic.
Well, you just described the epitome of parks, you know, different parks function in different ways. Jameson Square attracts, you know, literally 1,000 people,
and
including
birds.
Kids, in that artificial water feature. And then just two blocks away to the north is a fabulous faux wetland, Tanner Springs, which, by the way, for folks who haven't observed it, I've actually seen an osprey dive into that minuscule little water body there and catch a koi and fly to a nearby condo and eat it. Great blue heron hanging out there. And then the third in the triptych really is the fields, which is a large, you know, grassy area for frisbee throwing and so on and so forth. So that is a classic example of designing three different parks in a very close proximity to serve three different functions. And I'll have to say, I've gotten in arguments with Fred Kent, New York City Project for Public Spaces, who wrote a piece in the Tribune saying that Tanner Springs should be ripped up and a, quote, real park should be put
really?
In. Oh, yeah. Because in his mind, every park should have, you know, be overwhelmed with people. No. Tanner Springs Park serves its function as a contemplative place.
Yeah.
If you want to go two blocks away, go to Jameson Square,
active.
And you can be with 1,000 people.
Well, the other thing, too, about Tanner Springs is that I think we have so much wildlife in the city now. Why not have a park for the wildlife? And, I mean, Oaks Bottom and Forest Park and some of the other smaller nature parks serve that function to some degree. But I like the idea of having like a downtown gathering place for the Great Blue Heron.
The one thing that I would like to also see, and I wasn't able to do this in my career at parks, was to make sure that we had some rooftop gardens that were beyond the sedum variety and that we would have some more larger pieces, like on the High Line in New York City you just mentioned. They had some wonderful, wonderful place to stroll, and also some community gardens on rooftops in downtown Portland. Because if you go up in the bank tower and look down, it's pretty
black.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would also engage more people downtown and having some place to be in nature. So that's still to do.
Yep. But the Bureau of Environmental Services, Tom Lipton, who just retired, is their eco-roof guru, and Matt Berlin are, in fact, thinking in addition to stormwater management that we could, in fact, create some viable habitat for sure for the invertebrates like the pollinators and so forth, but even some birds. I think it would be wonderful to bring the common nighthawk back to Portland,
right,
which used to be really abundant.
Used to be in my neighborhood.
They're gone now. Yeah.
We actually are just about out of time, so we'll have this conversation again one of these days
soon.
Thank you so
much.
It's really fun.
Thank you, Barbara, for letting us talk about this. I appreciate it.
Great. And thanks, Mike, for joining us.
Yep, absolutely.
Again, and we'll probably see you again soon. We've been talking this morning with Leslie Paul Caspar, who's still involved with Portland's Community Garden Program, and Mike Houck, Director of Urban Spaces. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll hear more about the megaloads that are trying to move through Oregon, Idaho, and Montana on the way to the tar sands in northern Alberta, where my guest will be Kevin Lewis, Conservation Director for Idaho Rivers United. My engineer is Sam. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. We're going out with some music by the Incredible String Band.
I have every color there, it's true. Just lately when I look inside my painting box, I seem to pick the colors of you.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 10:59 a.m. At 11, Health Watch is off today, and we will instead hear Food Sleuth Radio, featuring an interview with dietitian April Winslow, looking at what does eating have to do with how we feel psychologically. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Sutri Irving speaks with Penny Rosenwasser about her new book, Hope into Practice, Jewish Women Choosing Justice Despite Our Fears. Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today, my guest is Ms. April Winslow, a fellow registered dietitian. In fact, we met at the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics annual meeting in Houston, where I heard her speak. She is the co-founder of the International Federation of Eating Disorder Dietitians. She's also the public policy liaison for Behavior Health Nutrition Practice Group of the Academy. And she is the founder of Choose to Change Nutrition Services based in San Jose, California. Now, I just want to let our listeners know that there are about 70,000 registered dietitians in the United States, and we all belong to different practice groups. And so my chosen path is hunger and environmental nutrition, and April's chosen path is looking at the behavior and health component of nutrition. So the session that I heard her speak at was called Food Matters, the connection between nutrition and psychotherapy. And the description was that the utilization of nutrition therapy by a dietitian with clients engaged in psychotherapy is often overlooked. Attempts at behavioral modification without homeostatic restoration may be futile. This session enhanced our awareness of the clinical presentation of a malnourished system and revives the fundamentals of nutritional biochemistry to help change lives. Wow. Welcome, April.
Thank you, Melinda. Thank you so much. And I want to thank your listeners so much for taking time to engage in our conversation. It would be wonderful if they were all with us, but I'm glad that they get to listen along with us.
Absolutely. And I want to just mention that